Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
For a C-sharp programmer or a Silverlight programmer who feels familiar with C-sharp, here's C-sharp 4 come along. What are the most important things in C-sharp 4 that programmer really wants to be aware of?
So the big thing that C-sharp 4 was really driving towards, in my view, was better support for COM interop with Office. I mean, that's a very narrow thing, but frankly, that was the thing that was used to be a nightmare before C-sharp 4 came along, and now with C-sharp 4, it's pretty straightforward and easy. Now, there are some language features in there that can be used in other ways, but in my view, that really was the biggest problem they were trying to solve. So you have things like the ability to consume dynamic things like the iDispatch objects that COM automation provides, and the VB.NET has always been able to consume in an easy fashion because that's always been a core concept in that language. Those were always awkward in C-sharp because C-sharp, prior to version 4, pretty much made the assumption that the compiler would have full knowledge of all the properties, all the methods you were going to consume. And the idea that the thing you were talking to might decide at runtime what members it was going to offer to you was pretty much an alien concept. And you had to go a long way out of your way to work with components that work that way. But that was a first-class citizen in the world of COM, that idea of dynamic properties, dynamic methods. And so you came across it. So C-sharp 4 makes that a lot easier. And there are some other sort of enhancements under the covers to make working with COM easier as well. So they've fixed a few of the problems around deployment and type libraries and interop, whatever they're called, the imported interop type information. A load of the infrastructure you just need to have present on the system for your C-sharp code to be able to talk to COM. That got easier with version 4. And it actually looks like a relatively sort of small surface area feature. That it's actually quite hard to sort of say, here are the big different differences in the language of C-sharp 4. The dynamic keyword really is the big one.
Well, that's the one I want to focus on, because the dynamic keyword was introduced, at least as I understand it, in large measure to meet the need that you're describing. And yet, well, let's talk about the dynamic keyword. Does it give you pause or concern?
There is one thing about it that worries me slightly, which is I have seen a few people talking about it with a view to using dynamic programming idioms in C-sharp. So, for example, if you do JavaScript development, it tends to look quite different from C-sharp development, because JavaScript is a purely dynamic language. It doesn't have the sort of static dispatch that we have in C-sharp. It always works out at runtime what thing this particular identifier refers to. So the same line of code, if it invoked some method on some object, could do completely different things each time you run it, because different objects can change what a particular member means. Even the same object can change over time, and you can do weird stuff like change stuff at a global level. So you can change for all objects what a particular thing means. It's all quite scary stuff if you're from a static background, but there are libraries out there that make interesting and effective use of these mechanisms to enable certain techniques. So, for example, to give you an area where arguably dynamic typing looks superior to static typing, it's in the world building mock objects for unit testing. So if I've got some code that expects to be given some library type, let's say it's a thing that's going to go and fetch some data from a web service, if I want to test that code, in a dynamic world, it's very easy to throw in a fake object, because if I just pass the method an object that has all the methods and properties that are expected, as long as it has all the things that the code under test is looking for, the code under test doesn't care that it's a different type of object. It's not the real thing, because it doesn't really mind. It just says, well, as long as it has a get this method and a do that method, I'm happy. And so it's just trivial to create fake objects for testing purposes. Whereas in C-sharp, you've got to do a lot more work to do that.
But is it a lot more work, or is it just creating an interface and having them both implement the interface?
Well, I mean, it's exactly that much work, except in situations where you actually can't do it because the thing you want to fake up is part of a system library and Microsoft didn't define an interface for you to derive from. So it might not actually be possible. At that point, you then have to write a wrapper for the underlying system type that implements an interface. So you end up providing a wrapper and a real implementation that's a wrapper and a fake implementation. It's not a huge amount of effort, and you can certainly do it. And I don't find it to be overly onerous, but I can see the argument that it's significantly more work than it is in dynamic languages. So, I mean, I wasn't sort of advocate. I wanted to show that as an illustration of why might someone think that a dynamic language is preferable before going on to explain why I don't think we should do that sort of thing in C sharp. So, take it as a given for now that there are some people prefer to do some things dynamically. Some of those people are then going to want to try that in C sharp. Now, here's the problem I have with that. The dynamic keyword is focused around this particular interop scenario. It was not, as I understand it, it was not the goal to support dynamic programming as a first-class citizen in C-sharp in the same way that object-oriented programming is supported and that arguably functional programming is supported. You know, those are idioms, you can use both of those in C-sharp. Are we now going to be able to use dynamic in the same sort of fully supported way? And I would say, actually, no, because there are certain things that don't, where the story doesn't quite line up. And particularly if you look at delegates, the ability to pass a reference to a method around. It's one of the great things about C-sharp, that we have this ability to pass methods freely from A to B. However, delegates and everything that are associated with them, like lambdas, revolve heavily around type inference, which is the ability for the compiler to work out what type of thing it should be using based on what you're doing. It can look the code you've written and go, this must be using this type here. And as soon as you go dynamic, you've robbed the compiler of the information that it needs to do this. And you tend to find that code that works with delegates, as soon as you try and put that into a dynamic world, the compiler has no idea what's going on. And ironically, you have to provide it with way more explicit typing information than you used to, just so it knows what you're doing. So you end up with this weird situation where trying to move to a dynamic idiom ends up adding the amount of times you have to tell the compiler explicitly what types you're dealing with, which is exactly the opposite of what people normally prefer dynamic languages for. And it's because a combination of things. It's because of the way that the delegate system integrates with the .NET type system, that there are some slightly sort of curious features of how they got that in there that aggravate this problem. But I suspect mainly it's because delegates are not a feature of COM interop. You know, there isn't really an analog to that in the world of COM. And so there was no particular need for the dynamic language features to provide a fully fledged story for supporting delegates. It's not that they don't work. You can stick a delegate in a dynamic variable and you can invoke it. The syntax for invoking delegates is supported on dynamic objects. The problem comes with the type inference breaking down. And there's actually a couple of examples of this in the C-sharp book where I illustrate some things you might want to do and then illustrate why they actually don't work in C-sharp like they would in a dynamic language. Because in a fully dynamic language like JavaScript, the very idea that a delegate might have a type would be a foreign concept. In JavaScript, you just have, you know, a function is a function is a function, and it doesn't really matter how many arguments it's got. You can try and invoke it, and it will. Yeah, it may even take a variable number of arguments. It might decide at runtime how many arguments it's going to accept, and there is no question as to needing to know what types of arguments it accepts because it's a dynamic language. You can pass it whatever arguments you like. So it's got a completely different philosophy to handling delegates in JavaScript. And C-sharp can't really work in that way because it's a little too committed to the statically typed world. And certainly in the way I write code, I make heavy use of delegates all the time. Not necessarily explicitly, but implicitly through things like link. That's generating delegates under the covers for you all the time. I use lambdas a lot as well. So that sort of world of C-sharp doesn't really fit with the world of dynamic. And so to my way of thinking, it's probably not a good idea to try and write dynamic code in C-sharp for the sake of writing dynamic code. I think that's an interop technology. That's what it's best at. That's what I would use it for.
And let's just close the circle by saying that dynamic and var, although on the surface similar, are radically different in that var is type safe and has an explicit type from the moment it's used.
I would say the basic idea there is spot on. I would quibble with some of your terminology.
Yeah, please fix that up for me, would you?
Yes. So I guess the first thing to say is that dynamic does what almost everyone thought var did when it came in, because var in JavaScript pretty much does what dynamic does in C-sharp. But so, first of all, var is always implicitly typed but it's always statically typed. So you never say what the type is, therefore it's not explicit typing, it's implicit typing, but you always know at the point of declaration what its type is. So if I say var foo equals something, foo has a particular type which cannot ever change. It is always some particular type. It will be whatever the type of the expression that initializes it was. So that's statically typed in that it's fixed to compile time, doesn't change, but implicitly typed because I don't have to say what the type is. So I would avoid the use of the word strongly typed because different people mean different things by it. A lot of academics who work in the world of languages would argue that JavaScript is a strongly typed language because what a lot of academics tend to mean by strong typing is that the behavior with respect to what happens when you do a particular thing to a variable that contains a particular type of data, the behavior is well defined. That's what they tend to mean by strongly typed. And these academics would regard a language such as C or C++ as being weakly typed because you can take a pointer of one type and cast it to a completely different type. And if you get your casts wrong, you got no idea what's going to happen. The C++ spec actually says behavior is undefined in a bunch of those scenarios. And so to the classic academic language way of thinking, that makes C and C++ weakly typed languages, whereas JavaScript is strongly typed in that there are no undefined scenarios. You always know what's going to happen. This is sort of backwards to how a lot of people tend to think of it in the Windows development culture. So frankly, I just avoid the keyword, avoid the word strongly typed, the phrase strongly typed, because it seems to mean the exact opposite thing to different groups of people.
And that whole explanation is why it's always brilliant talking to you, because I think I understood all of that, and I'm going to go back and listen to that a couple of times. But you have nailed, I think you put the final nail in the coffin of confusing var and dynamic in C#, which is to the good. Now, one of the things that you've said a couple of times is that you use link fairly heavily. And do you recommend that Silverlight and Windows Phone programmers become quite proficient in link?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would certainly be a mistake to look at link and think that it's just about data because it happens to resemble SQL, for example. So that the majority of the link queries that I write are actually based on link to objects. It's all doing stuff on the client side or doing stuff with information that's already come back from the server. Because it has surprised me actually how much I use it, because when link was first announced back at the 2005 PDC, gosh, half a decade ago, wow, I remember thinking, well, I love all of the Lambda stuff. I love what they've done with extension methods. I like the whole thinking behind this. I like the way all the providers are consistent and they've said, here's what you do to expose this stuff. But I wasn't sure about the query syntax. The query syntax, when I first saw it, struck me as the least satisfactory piece because it was a bit more fixed. All the other language features, like Lambda's extension methods, type inference, and so on, could be used in other ways. They were features that supported what Link was trying to do, but were actually more general purpose. Whereas my initial impression of the query syntax was like, well, it does this one thing and doesn't do anything else. At the time, I felt I wanted something a bit more Lisp-like, where you could actually extend the language and define new keywords and new structures and then have the query syntax built on top of that. However, I then started trying to use it and then discovered that I loved it. And I was amazed at actually how often problems I was trying to solve in C# turned out to be naturally represented in link. Turns out it's quite common to be dealing with collections of data and to want to do things to those collections, particularly in my experience in the user interface.
Well, we're certainly seeing that not only has link become prevalent in C# programming, but Lambda expressions have branched out well beyond any kind of querying, and seeing even Lambda expressions substituting for registration of event handlers.
Yeah, I think Lambdas are interesting for all sorts of reasons. I happen to be very interested in languages in general and like to read around on different programming languages, academic ones as well. And it turns out that the academic folks have sort of been saying this for decades. One of the big things about Lisp, for example, was that it used sort of the idea of a lambda throughout the whole system. And it turns out to be a very powerful composition technique. And this really hit the mainstream of C-sharp in Link. And actually, I think part of the genius of the Link query syntax was that it let you use lambdas without even necessarily having to think that you were doing it. It integrated the composition into the syntax in a way that was less intimidating than most of the academic languages tend to make it. I think lambdas are actually not that complicated an idea once you get your head around them. But they look a bit scary. They have this academic sounding name that puts people off. But actually, they're just a really convenient way of plugging in a bit of code into the middle of something else. It's a composition mechanism. It's a really straightforward way of doing that. And in a lot of ways, it can be more flexible than some of the object-oriented techniques people sometimes try and use to solve the same problem. So yeah, I think, you know, lambdas, delegates in general, but lambdas in particular with their very simple, straightforward syntax are a huge feature of what I like about C#.
And can you say a bit about the advantage of using lambda expressions over delegate syntax?
So yeah, the developments of all these different ways of doing what eventually boiled down to delegates under the covers, they're all really the same construct at the .NET, at the CLR level. The runtime doesn't distinguish between a delegate or a lambda or an anonymous method. They're all the same thing as far as it's concerned. We had a sort of series of different syntaxes over different versions of C#. So in C#1, each thing that was a different method under the covers had to be a different method on the surface in C#. Then C#2 allowed us to do what we call anonymous methods, but we didn't have the lambda syntax. So with anonymous methods, you had to say, use the delegate keyword, and then optionally follow that by the argument list, and then use curly braces inside of that. C#3 added this new syntax, which in a lot of ways seems like just a slightly more compact way of saying the same thing. So rather than having to spell out the word delegate followed by the argument list, you just write the argument list. And then we have this little sort of arrow thing that you and I tend to pronounce goes to, but different people pronounce differently, the little arrow thing. It's in some ways just a more succinct syntax for doing what we used to do with the delegate keyword. However, it also enables some other stuff. So in C#3, they introduced the ability for a expression to either compile just like it was a normal delegate, or to compile in a way that gave you a description of the code rather than actually compiling into the executable code. So you could end up with a bunch of objects that said, here's a lambda, it takes these arguments, the first thing it does is this, the next thing it does is that. It's got a an if statement, it's got an add operator or whatever. You could actually inspect the code inside it, which is an immensely powerful thing for certain kinds of applications. It meant that you could write code that looked at other code and modified its behavior based on that. And this is important to things like transforming Link queries into database queries, for example. It's also used in things like the OData wrappers that we're seeing in Silverlight. It can generate a query on a URL based on some code you've written in C#. It's sort of clever stuff. So expressions enabled that. Are they fundamentally necessary to enable that? I'm not so sure. I do think this is sort of one of the historical, slightly weird edges of C#, that you end up with two different syntaxes for doing sort of inline functions and methods. If they were doing it from scratch today, would they still have both? I'm not so sure, because I can't come up with a good argument for why you need both. I would admit that I do still use both, and the main reason I sometimes use both is because the advantage of the older C#2 era delegate keyword syntax is that you can get away without saying what the arguments are. You can say, I want to provide a method here where this thing's expecting a method, and I am not remotely interested in any of the arguments it's going to pass me, so don't make me specify them. Here's the code. And that's sometimes useful, particularly actually with the TPL. You can just say, well, look, I'm not passing any data in. I just want to run this code on a worker thread, for example. In that situation, the delegate keyword can sometimes be more convenient. In other situations, the lambda syntax can be more convenient, but they're sort of... If I was trying to explain to someone new to the language why you have both and why and when you'd use both, one versus the other, it would be one of those slightly awkward situations where you have to explain the history of the language to explain how we ended up with the syntax we do, I think.
Well, then let me ask you about two border conditions. One is the creation of events, which traditionally is the declaration of a delegate and then adding the event keyword.
Ah, so hang on. Now we're talking about the declaration of a delegate type. So thus far in the conversation, when I've been talking about a delegate, I've tended to be referring to a particular instance, a particular snippet of code as a delegate.
Yes.
And there's a similar relationship between delegates and delegate types as there is between objects and classes. So the delegate type is a bit like the class definition. It says, here's the type, and then you instantiate that. So we're now moving into the world of the type definition. So yes, as you say, you would declare a delegate type and then use the event keyword. So are you asking about when would I use an event versus when would I pass a function as an argument to another function?
Is that... Well, I think that's a valid question. The question I was asking was really aimed at bringing out that distinction about a delegate type. And so if one were asking, why are there still delegates? Why aren't they deprecated in the language? One place would be that at the moment, when we talk about delegate types, they have a utility that link or lambda expressions do not replace.
Right. I think I would position that slightly differently, because even if you're using lambdas and you're not explicitly programming in terms of delegates in C#, the CLR under the covers still thinks in terms of delegates. The CLR does not have a concept for representing a lambda. A lambda is a C# syntax which can be used either to generate a lambda, to generate a delegate, or to generate an expression tree, depending on which mode you use it in. So the delegates are still the underlying stuff, if you like. So you wouldn't want those to be inaccessible from C#, because it's useful to be able to see the real thing. And in any case, they surface, because if you're declaring a function that accepts either a delegate or a lambda, what you're actually going to declare is a function that takes a delegate. Because the decision as to whether to use a delegate or a lambda is more of a style thing. I'm calling this existing method. It wants me to pass a delegate. I have a choice. I can use the delegate syntax. I can use the lambda syntax. Or I can just give it the name of a method and make the method a completely separate thing. Those are three separate choices that C# language syntax gives me. But they all boil down to the same underlying runtime constructs.
And where does action fit into that compendium?
So action... is actually a family of delegate types. There's more than one. So possibly the best way to explain this is to wind back a bit and explain a problem that we used to have. Sometimes it is useful to define a method that takes another method as an argument. So a classic example of this would be to deal with the cross-threading issues in user interface code. Most UI frameworks on Windows require that you be on the right thread to update the UI. And if you're on the wrong thread, there's a thing you can use to get back on the right thread. The details of what that thing is don't particularly matter, but there's something you can use to kick off some code back on the UI thread. And you've got to tell it what code you'd like it to run. And so the natural mechanism for that is to give it a delegate. So here's a delegate pointing to the method I'd like you to run when we can get control of the UI thread next. Now, that means you're calling a method that says, please do this work on the UI thread, and you're passing in a method to that method. You're passing in a pointer to the code you'd like to run. So the one and only mechanism that the CLR offers for supporting this is that thing you pass in is a delegate. So that's how we pass pointers to methods in .NET under the covers. It's always some instance of some delegate type. And you have to say what delegate type is. There has to be a type definition, like there is for any argument. Anytime you pass an argument into a method, you've got to say what type is actually expected. Do we expect an integer? Do we expect a string? Do we expect a method that's going to take one argument? Do we expect a method that's going to take two arguments? Because if I'm going to invoke your method, I've got to know how to invoke it. So there's an expectation of what shape of data we're passing in. And that's true whether it's a class or a struct or a number or a method. In all cases, I need to know what shape of thing is expected by the library service I'm using. And so, for certain cases, you often wanted, just a method that doesn't take any arguments. Please call this thing back later, and I don't want to pass it any data because I just need some code to be invoked. Or maybe I wanted to take a single argument. That's a very common thing. Please call this method back, and so that I can remember what I was doing at the time, please pass it this object that will help it remember, help me work out why I'm being called back in the first place. And those crop up all over the place in things like timer routines. And unfortunately, back in the early days of .NET, what people used to do was to define their own delegate types to represent this sort of thing. So, for example, the Windows Forms team invented a delegate type called Method Invoker, which was a type that represented methods that took no arguments. So you just had, you know, an argument-free method. And then you had things like timer callbacks that the timer classes would invent to represent, you know, their callbacks. And you had the thread start delegate. And you basically ended up with lots of things that were essentially structurally the same. Five different teams within Microsoft would all invent their own delegate type that was a delegate that took no arguments, or a method that took one argument, or a method that took two arguments. And this was a bit sort of insane, because you end up with lots of different ways of expressing the same thing. And so to resolve this, they said, well, look, let's just define one type that everyone agrees on. Action is a type that it's a delegate type, and it's able to point to any method that takes no arguments. And then there's another action, action of T. That's a generic type with a single type argument. And in .NET, you're allowed to have two types of the same name, but different numbers of generic arguments, and they're considered to be different types. So action of T is a distinct type that represents methods that take one argument of type T, where T is
both returning void.
Both returning void. Yeah, they have no return data. And then action of T1 and T2 takes two arguments of type T1 and T2. And then you mentioned return types. That there's kind of a parallel family of delegate class, of delegate types called func. And func is very similar, but there is a return value. So there is no argumentless func, because a func always needs at least one type, which is the return type. So func of T result, I think it's called, is a function that takes no arguments but returns a T result. So you might say func of string. Then there's a two argument one, func of T, comma, T result. That's a func that takes one argument and returns whatever T result is. So you could say func of int, comma, string. That will be a function that takes an integer and returns a string. And then func of T1, comma, T2, comma, T result, for anything that takes two arguments and returns one thing, and so on. So by providing one definition for each of these common patterns, it means that you don't end up with each bit of the class library defining their own me too version of the same pattern. So now everyone agrees this is how we represent void methods that take no arguments. This is how we represent void methods that take one argument. This is how we represent void methods that take two arguments, and so on. It just means that there's one sort of central definition.
Well, I have to say, I could do this all day with you, and because your expositions are just brilliant and clarify in the extreme. Let me wind this up by asking you a little bit about how you spend your day and what kinds of work you're working on right now.
There isn't really sort of one representative day. So I spent most of last week in Bangor, just outside of Belfast in Northern Ireland, teaching a WPF training course for Pluralsight, who I do training for. Next week, I'm going to be off to a customer helping, doing some consulting work to help tuning with performance of video playback and stuff in a WPF application. This week, in between those two jobs, I am sat at home working on content for Pluralsight's on-demand service. So we do online training courses, and I'm going to be recording more content for that. And I'm also helping other instructors at Pluralsight get up to speed. I've also written a blog entry today. I spend a fair amount of time on Stack Overflow these days. So, and also I do development from home sometimes. So I'll have weeks or months where I'm spending most days just sat in front of Visual Studio generating code. So there isn't one answer, but I hope that gives you a flavor of how my weeks might be.
No, it absolutely does. And we'll be sure to get your blog, a link to your blog on the page for this podcast, so that folks who want to read more of what you have to say can follow that link. And
I'm also on Twitter, by the way, but no one finds me because I have a slightly obscure Twitter handle. I'm IDG10, which I use in all places where my real name is gone, because that used to be my log on to the university mainframe when I was at university. So that's also me on the Xbox. But yeah, IDG10 is me. So
Well, we'll keep that in mind as well. I cannot possibly thank you enough for this, and we will absolutely have to do this again and pick up a bit more of the inside of C Sharp, which exploring with you is always a blast.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. For those of you who've made it through this far through the podcast, thank you for bearing with me, with us, and my tendency to go on at length. I hope it was interesting. And thank you, Jesse, for getting me involved in this. It's been fun.